Chapter 23. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 11 p.m., Branston, Connecticut. Stop. I don't know that this word has ever left my mouth before. We lie on the black leather sofa that smells of scotch, bodies pressed together as we make this treacherous journey from strangers to lovers. I push him away and sit up. I try to straighten my hair, but my fingers get caught in a tangled mess.
What's wrong?
He asks. I shouldn't have come here. Now he is sitting beside me. He thinks he understands what's happening as he reaches for the glasses on the floor.
Okay, he says. Here.
He hands me a drink. I take a sip. I shouldn't have posted those things about myself.
What things?
Now he gets nervous. Just everything. And the pictures, and tonight. I shouldn't have worn this dress and these shoes. I never wear red lipstick.
But you look nice. I'm not sure what you're saying. I get that you don't always look like this, made up, dressed up. I was married for 6 years, he says.
This makes me look at him. And what about you? What are you hiding? I ask. He shrugs and smiles that smile that caught my eye.
There's not really much I can do. I shaved, put on a nice shirt.
That's not what I meant.
I know.
Then he gets up, walks to the kitchen. He grabs his keys from the counter.
Come on, he says. I'll walk you to your car. I don't want you to be here if you don't feel comfortable.
I don't move. Not one single muscle. I don't want to leave. Rosie never understood. I can hear the same conversation looping over and over. It's the one where she tells me it's not that complicated. You go on a date, you talk about superficial things, you meet again, you talk some more, reveal some more. Little by little, you ease into the water, making sure it's not too hot or too cold or too deep or too muddy.
There's nothing that time won't reveal, she said.
But she is wrong about that. The day Dick left us, he came to our rooms to say goodbye. He came to me first. He stood at the doorway while I sat on my bed.
Has your mother told you that I'm moving out?
I nodded. Our mother told us through tears, through desperate words and despair, that our hugs could not come. Four arms wrapped around her as she stood in the hallway, suitcases piled beside her.
I'll see you on the weekends.
I nodded again. I knew it was a lie. He couldn't leave my room fast enough. He went next to Rosie. I heard him knock on her door. I heard it open and then close, and when it did, I ran from my room and pressed my ear against the hollow wood. Rosie was crying, and he was comforting her, making those sounds people make to babies. Shh. He told her about the weekends and how everything was for the best. Rosie yelled at him then. I couldn't believe it. Sweet, obedient Rosie, yelling at Dick. Why do you have to live with that woman? Dick opened his stupid mouth and said his stupid words.
Because I love her. Someday you'll love someone and you'll understand.
Stupid, selfish Dick. Rosie cried again. Dick said shh again. But then he said something else. Something unexpected.
Your mother is no saint.
Rosie stopped crying and I heard footsteps. I ran back to my room and closed the door. Dick left Rosie on her bed with her red eyes and wet face. He walked down the hallway and down the stairs. We both came out of our rooms, Rosie and I. We stood together in that hallway, listening to the last sounds our father would ever make in our house, and to the final pleas of our mother. Don't go. Don't leave us. I know Rosie felt it then, the same way I did when we heard our mother. Nails on a chalkboard. I never asked Rosie what Dick meant about our mother not being a saint, and she never asked me. Now we are adults. We've known our mother all our lives. What good has time done to reveal the truth about our father, about our mother, about any of us?
Nothing. That's what. I don't want to leave, I say. He's frustrated with me. I can see how he's tensed up and I want to change it. I want to make it stop. It begins with recognition. But I don't care why I feel this way, how broken I am, how wrong I am. I can't go back to Rosie's attic and wait for a call from this man who's standing in front of me right here and right now. I think about the last time I saw Kevin. I feel the words, I love you, sink into my bones, transforming me cell by cell. Hands releasing fists, peace visible on the horizon of what has been a restless life. I went home that night and conned myself into believing it was here to stay. And then it was all torn out of me. I can't go home and wait for it to come again, not again. So I give him what he wants, or maybe the runner-up. I give him my darkest secret. That night that you read about, the night that boy was killed, it was my fault. Frustration. Gone.
Okay,
he says. He sets down his keys and grabs the bottle of scotch. Then he returns to the empty living room and sits beside me. I'd been dating him, Mitch Adler. He wasn't a good guy, but that made me fight even harder. I begin. My hands are shaking. He steadies them as he refills my glass.
One of the wolves?
He asks, smiling because he remembers my story about Catholic school. I'd forgotten telling him. I've told him so many things. 3 hours is a long time to talk to a stranger. I think I found the leader of the pack with that one. It was stupid high school head games. I can see that now. But at the time, it had me in knots.
I had a friend who always fell for guys like that. We were in college then, so don't feel so bad.
Everyone has a friend like that. Most of them learn from their mistakes. I went to the party that night knowing he'd be there. He hadn't called me for weeks. He hadn't returned any of my messages.
And you didn't assume it was over?
I look away and don't answer. It sounds ridiculous to tell this story now, as a grown woman. I'm hearing the words in my head, and I don't want to say them. He swirls his glass, takes a drink.
I get it. We were all in high school once. Just tell me what happened.
I cringe, but then say these ridiculous words. He came to the party with his girlfriend, the one I didn't know about until that night, Brittany. I already told you that part.
You must have been upset,
he says, trying to move things along. He's been wanting to hear this story all night, and I don't care why. I don't care about my list, which now includes this empty apartment. There is something about him that has reached me, and I want to hold on to it. I was devastated. I wouldn't show it, of course. I pretended not to see him. I went to get another beer, but then I felt a hand on my arm.
So the silent treatment worked.
It was part of our script. He asked me how the rest of my summer was, and I said it was great. I turned away, pretended to be part of a conversation going on next to us. Then I felt him push my hair away from the back of my neck. He leaned in close, whispered in my ear that he needed to see me alone. I thought maybe that girl was just a friend, that I had overreacted. We went behind some trees, kissed, laughed. He said he'd missed me. This is where I should need to stop, because the memory of that night is too painful. Because it tortures me to go back there. But a wall has grown around the story. I didn't ask for it, but it's there now. It stands on its own. It never asks for maintenance or permission to be there. And I like it just fine. I don't need to stop. So I continue with only feigned emotion. He took a step back then. He smiled and folded his arms and soaked up the love that was radiating from my body. It was like he just turned the valve a little to the left and it started to flow right out of me. I thought his smile was from being happy, happy that I loved him and that we were sharing this moment.
But then he started to tell me about the girl he'd walked in with. This is the part where I do pause. One hand squeezes the glass. The other begins to close, fingers bending in perfect unison until they reach for the palm. The smell of fire. The damp brush of the deep woods. We steal a kiss behind a tree. He breaks away. He looks at me with tenderness, and I have a moment where I believe that I have finally done it. I have given enough. Been enough. He opens his mouth to speak. I think the words before he says them. But he didn't say the words old me was waiting for. The small child tugging on a sleeve, wide eyes, pleading eyes. And the words that he did say filled me with a bigger rage than I had ever known. Jonathan has guessed it.
He told you she was his girlfriend, he says.
I nod. He said he needed to get back to her. And the thing is, I was not the kind of girl who would cry and beg and plead. That was my mother, so I knew it was useless. And besides that, it repulsed me, violently, to show any sign of weakness, even if I was weak. So instead, I just shrugged. I told him he'd better go then, before she got mad at him. I see us now, in my glass of scotch. I see Mitch and remember the swirling together of warm, lusty bliss and red-hot rage. Danger waking me from the illusion of safety. My hands and fists at my sides, but a smile on my face, because I knew how to win that fight. Or at least I thought I did. Then he said, changing course, I could send her home. He was a worthy opponent that way. When I didn't try to stop him, he brought out bigger guns. I said he should do what he wants, and he said that he had a dilemma. I hear his words. I'm back in those woods.
I have a dilemma.
What dilemma?
I know she loves me, but I don't think you do.
He said I needed to prove it to him.
What the hell did he mean by that? Jonathan asks.
He seems genuinely pissed off on my behalf. He meant exactly what you think he meant, I say. He wanted me to sleep with him.
Well, I hope you realize what was going on.
Jonathan is so sweet to be concerned for me 11 years after the fact. Of course I realized what was going on. The boy I loved wanted me to have sex with him as a condition to staying with me, to loving me. Not exactly earth-shattering stuff.
So what did you do? Jonathan asks.
His eyes are wide, his brow furrowed. I laughed like it was no big deal. I told him I'd been with someone else all summer, so he missed his chance to be my first. I told him I was worried he wouldn't measure up, but I was happy to find out. Let's go, I said. Honestly, this story should make you go back to the kitchen and grab your keys and walk me straight to my car. Jonathan places a hand on my shoulder.
Why? Because you were young and in love and couldn't make the best decision?
It's more than that. Most girls would have run away in tears, cried to their friends, got shit-faced, puked, then gotten on with their lives. That's what Rosie would have done. I'm not digging for sympathy or for one more person to let me off the hook for my self-destructive behavior. I hate this part of me, then, now, and every moment in between. She is undeserving of sympathy. I look at Jonathan Fielding and wonder if it's this part of me that has drawn me to him, that let him inside my head, which is the straightest path to my heart. I've paused to drink and ponder. Jonathan is eager for the end. He says nothing but stares at me with that serious expression. But I'm not like those other girls, not like my sister. I rattled off things I could do with him, using as many obscenities as possible, and then I asked him if he knew what he was doing because I didn't want to waste the night on him if he didn't.
Jesus,
Jonathan says. He smiles.
Ballsy move.
It was some strange game we were playing then. I was waiting for him to blink. He was waiting for me. Neither of us did.
Did he answer the question?
No. He just smiled and said something slick like, "Don't worry, you'll enjoy it."
So that's why he went to his car. He called your bluff.
Jonathan treads carefully. He wants the end of this story, and I want the end of our story, me and Jonathan Fielding. I want the journey to be over. I'm so tired. And now my head spins from the scotch.
You don't have to tell me the rest, he says.
But he doesn't mean it. I am so close to opening my mouth and rendering my confession. I don't want to break the spell of intimacy that pulls us together. I smile sadly and look away. I think suddenly about the notes, the threats. If someone wanted me to pay for that night, why am I still here? Why am I not in jail or lying in a hospital bed? Why am I not dead and buried? What are they waiting for? To torture me?
Laura, he says, his hand on my cheek now, turning my head to face him.
So gently.
I don't care about that night. I can see that it still upsets you.
Liar, I think. He would have to be an idiot not to care about that night, and Jonathan Fielding is no idiot. Notes, notes, notes. I've been home for 5 weeks. I've received 3 notes. And now I'm on a date with a stranger who's been asking me about that night in the woods. I stand up from the couch. My head spins and spins, scotch and confusion.
What's wrong? He asks.
I don't answer because I don't know. Except, perhaps, one small thing.
Laura, tell me what's wrong.
He grabs my hand as I turn to walk away. I stare at him and think, something. Something is very wrong.
Chapter 24. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 8:30 a.m., New York City. Rosie sat at a small table, a fresh cup of coffee in front of her.
Do you take milk?
Laura's roommate, Kathleen, worked as a graphic designer for a marketing firm downtown. Laura had found her through an advertisement. They had not been friends, but there had been no complaints either. They shared a 2-bedroom walk-up on Jane Street. Laura worked long hours. She rarely ate at home. Kathleen had a boyfriend in New Jersey and was gone most weekends. That was all Laura had said about it. Rosie had been there a few times before when she'd come to visit her sister, and every time her roommate had been gone. Yes, thanks, Rosie answered.
I'm sorry I didn't get back to you yesterday. It didn't sound urgent, your message, Kathleen said apologetically as she walked back into the kitchen.
I didn't know what was happening. I wasn't sure, and I didn't know how close you were to my sister. That seems strange now, that I didn't know. You were never here when we came to visit her. Rosie could see Laura's room through the small living space next to the kitchen. The door was open, the room bare. Did she take everything when she left? Rosie asked. The day she'd picked Laura up, the boxes had already been packed and moved to the street. Kathleen returned with a pint of milk, and she sat down. Her eyes followed Rosie's through the adjacent room to the open door.
She did, Kathleen answered. That's how I knew she wasn't coming back. The furniture is mine, just a bed and a desk. The closet has built-ins, so she didn't need a dresser. You can look if you want, but I went through it after a few days. I've been showing it again.
If you don't mind, I might just walk through. Rosie's hand was shaking when she picked up the coffee. She set it back down, drew her hands to her face. Kathleen looked at her with caution, as though she didn't want to be pulled into the storm.
So what's happened exactly?
I don't know what's happened. That's the problem. She went on a date with a man she met online, and she never came home.
How long has it been? Kathleen asked. She used to leave for days at a time. I never knew when she would be here, when she was coming home. She worked long hours. And she traveled. She was covering industrial chemicals, she said. Took the train to Pennsylvania, upstate New York. Sometimes she flew. She wasn't one to...
Kathleen couldn't find the right words, so Rosie finished the thought. I know. She wasn't one to be considerate of other people in her life. People who might worry about her or wonder where she was. Kathleen looked at Rosie and nodded. I got used to it. I never worried about her.
It's different, Rosie said. She had my car. She knew I would worry if she didn't come home, or call at least.
You're right, Kathleen said. I didn't mean to imply that she was inconsiderate. It wasn't like that. If she thought I worried about her when she was gone, she would have let me know where she was. Things I cared about, like dishes in the sink or taking out the recycling, she never forgot those things. We were friendly, but not friends, if that makes any sense.
It did. It made perfect sense. Laura wasn't used to people worrying about her, caring about her enough to worry. Did you know her boyfriend? The one she had right before she left?
Not really, she said.
But Rosie could tell she had an opinion. Did she tell you what happened? Why she left New York? Left her job?
She just said she needed a change.
Kathleen looked back toward Laura's room.
I came home one Sunday night and found her in there. She was sitting on her bed, staring out the window. She was sitting in the dark, no lights on anywhere in the apartment. It took me by surprise when I saw her. It was so quiet, so dark. I went to the edge of the door and knocked on the wall just outside. I didn't want to bother her if she wanted to be alone. She had a glass of something in her hand, resting on her knee. Both feet were on the floor. Her hair was falling around her face. It was hard to tell, but I think she'd been crying. I asked her what was wrong, and she just said that it was over with the guy. She never told me his name. I asked her if I could help, if she wanted to talk. She thanked me, politely, but then said she would be fine. She just needed a little time. I asked her if she wanted the door open or closed, and she said closed. So I closed her door, turned on the lights, took a shower, made some food. She never came out. I thought she'd gone to bed, but she must have started packing because the next afternoon she was gone. The room was cleared out. She left me a check for 2 months' rent and a note saying she was moving home for a while. That was it. Rosie stared at Laura's roommate, picturing this scene. It was so familiar. Rosie had found her like that countless times when they were still living on Deer Hill Lane. Laura, sitting on the edge of her bed, in the dark, staring out a window. I tried to call her, Kathleen said eagerly. She didn't answer and didn't return the call. Like I said, we weren't friends, so I didn't think it was my place to do more than that.
Rosie smiled sadly. No, don't feel bad. You couldn't have done anything.
Still, Kathleen said, now she's missing. I wish I'd found out more that night. Maybe it would be helpful.
Rosie got up. Can I look in the room? She asked.
Of course.
They walked from the kitchen to the living room, then to the doorway of Laura's room. Kathleen walked past her and turned on the light.
This is it, she said. Just the bed and desk.
Rosie stood still for a moment. The room had been so full of life the last time she'd been there, before the day she moved out. It was in the spring, and the windows were open. Jane Street was lined with trees, and the smell of blooming leaves had been coming through on a cool gust of air. Laura had a bright orange quilt that Mason had found irresistible. My son was here last spring, jumping on that bed. Rosie walked to the window and looked out at the street below. It was May, before she'd met him. Rosie tried to remember that day. I would have remembered if she had. Laura was always different when she had a new man in her life.
I couldn't say one way or another. I'm sorry. She mentioned him in passing over the summer. She wanted to bring him here for the weekend and asked me if I minded. I was leaving anyway, so I said it was fine.
He was married, Rosie blurted out. He had kids.
Oh,
Kathleen said. She was visibly surprised.
I had no idea. But that doesn't seem like Laura. The few times we spoke about more than the apartment, she was very earnest. Maybe that's not the right word, but that does surprise me. Did she know?
What? About the wife and kids?
Yeah.
How could she not?
If it wasn't on the internet, if he was a good liar. I've heard a lot of stories.
But after months, wouldn't she wonder why he hadn't taken her to his apartment? Kathleen considered this. Maybe he had another apartment. It just doesn't seem like Laura, from what I could tell about her. She made some comments about your father, about his affairs. I don't know the whole story, but wasn't she estranged from him because of it? Rosie sat on the bed and looked at Kathleen. She was. I've only seen him a few times over the years. He hasn't even met my son. But honestly, I don't know if that would be enough to stop her. If he said the right things, told her stories about his unhappy marriage, if he told her he loved her.
Yeah, I suppose that would get to any of us under the right circumstances.
Kathleen looked out the window as though she wanted to fly right out of it, away from this conversation, away from the trouble of Laura Lochner. Rosie had already delayed her in leaving the city to visit her boyfriend. But like it or not, there was more to tell. It doesn't even matter anymore. Something happened to him, to Kevin Brody. He was killed. She waited for the appropriate response. Shock, silence, apprehension. It was a robbery outside his gym. Laura never said anything. She said he'd broken it off with one text and then ghosted her, you know? No calls. Texts.
My God. When was he killed?
Rosie pulled out her phone and found the article from the Post. Mid-August. Early morning. Then she had a thought. She turned abruptly and looked at Kathleen. When did you find her here, in the room, crying?
I don't know. It was on a Sunday night, as I said.
He was killed on a Wednesday. I wonder if it was before or after you saw her. If her despair was new or days old.
What are you saying? That Laura might have done something?
Kathleen was stunned. Rosie caught hold of herself. No, of course not. It just means that maybe she didn't know. Maybe it explains why he stopped returning her calls.
And she thought he'd ghosted her after the breakup. God, how horrible.
Yes, Rosie thought, but not nearly as horrible as the alternative. Rosie got up and walked to the small desk on the other side of the room. She checked the drawers, felt beneath the surface. She opened the closet and did the same. Then under the bed. There was nothing. Did she have any friends who might know something? I've called her office, the woman named Jill she spoke about, but I didn't know any of her friends here, and even from college. Kathleen shook her head.
I wouldn't know, but wait, there was a man. I heard her talking to him when I came home one night. She was cooking, and he was on the speaker. She offered to pick it up, but I could see she needed two hands, and I was going to my room anyway.
Rosie stopped her search and looked at Kathleen. A man. Did you hear what they were saying? Was it her boyfriend?
No, I don't think so. They were talking about the boyfriend. Laura was saying something about him to the man on the phone. Hold on, I'll remember his name.
Rosie stood before her impatiently.
And I think he was here, actually, outside the apartment. I was working from home that day, so she left without her keys, which she couldn't find. I heard the buzzer and looked out the window. It was Laura, and she was there with a man. He was wearing a suit. He had his jacket draped over his arm. It was hot as hell that day. I was surprised she was home so soon. She never left work early. I don't think she took one sick day the whole time she was living here.
What did he look like? Rosie asked.
Wait, I remember his name,
Kathleen said, her eyes lit up.
It was Joe.
Rosie stared at the woman, unable to speak or move, her husband's name now ringing in her ears.
Are you all right? Kathleen asked.
But Rosie didn't answer. Joe. That was all she could hear. The sound of her husband's name.
Chapter 25. Laura. Session number 14. 7 weeks ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
This isn't a good idea, having more sessions. Things have become complicated. We never should have started.
Laura. No, please. I'm so close. I can feel everything shifting.
Dr. Brody. Laura. All right. Close your eyes. Can you see yourself as someone else? Another woman there in the woods with Mitch Adler?
Laura. I think so. Dr. Brody.
He pulls her behind a tree, kisses her. She can feel his desire, and it makes her believe that she's finally done it. She's finally made him feel safe enough to love her. There's a rush, euphoria. You know what it's made of. You've told me.
Laura, power. It's the rush of power. Dr. Brody.
What do you want to say to her? That girl in the woods?
Laura, that it's just an illusion? He'll never love you? Dr. Brody.
Don't ask me. Tell me. You're the one who has to see it.
Laura. Okay, fine. I would tell her that he'll never love you, so stop trying. Dr. Brody.
Right. Exactly. He is never going to love her. The power is an illusion.
Laura. I would tell her to walk away, but I know she won't. She never will. Why is that? Dr. Brody.
That's because you can't forgive her for trying. And you want her to suffer for it.
Chapter 26. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 11:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. I find my purse in the kitchen. I search for my phone.
Laura.
Jonathan Fielding stands behind me. I feel his hand on my shoulder. And I stop. I stop looking for my phone. I stop looking for a way to leave. My body moves back until it touches his. It is disconnected now. It doesn't listen as I remind it of the things that are wrong.
Shh, he whispers. It's all right. Catch your breath. Your phone is dead, remember?
A chill races through me. His voice is soft, but his words, are they ominous? Is he trying to remind me that I'm helpless now, trapped between the counter and his body? The door on the other side. Another hand touches another shoulder, and suddenly no part of me is free. We have different phones, different chargers. It's already been discussed and acknowledged that I can't do anything until I get back to Rosie's. The chill morphs into a heat wave. And I like the heat.
Do you want me to get you home?
He says. But he might as well ask a child to put down an ice cream cone. It was a black Chevy Impala, I say. Suddenly, I need to finish the story. I need to know why he's been asking me to tell it, and if he knows the ending, maybe the truth will reveal itself. He'll have no further need to pull it out of me. I have to know what this is. From ignorance comes insanity, and he seems so real to me, this man. I have been observing him, listening with such care, making my list, those little things that seem wrong. But there are so many things that seem right. I used to tease him about his car because it was an old man's car. His father gave it to him when he upgraded to a Lexus, so it was actually just that, an old man's car. Jonathan's arms grow tighter around me, locking together in front of my chest. I can feel every inch of him now. The metal buckle of his belt against the small of my back, the front of his thighs pressing into the back of mine, his chest running up my back, so warm and strong. He whispers again, "You don't have to do this." But I don't stop. I'd been there with him before, in the back of that car. Many times. And many times he had asked me. Many times he'd pulled me just a little closer to that point they warned us about in school. I laugh then, and when I do, I realize I've been crying. The tears that come find old tracks down my face.
"Sex ed," he says, laughing as well. "The point of no return."
He says this in a deep, mocking voice, and I feel his body move with the laughter that rolls from his belly. Exactly, I say. I don't know why I'm laughing as hard as I am. It's not funny. A few more words and a boy will be dead. But the sadness seeps out of every seam. I remember being scared, and I remember being excited. I was 17, already late to the party. No one would have cared, and at least it would have been over, you know? All the anxiety and anticipation. I think the only reason I waited that long was because of him. It was all I had left that I hadn't given him. I think carefully about what to say next. The words that line up are not the ones I want him to hear. It felt like this. Just like this. There is heat between us, tension. One hand strays until it reaches my stomach. His lips find my neck. I feel him melting. And then we were there, in the car, and everything else. The other girl, the way he'd been all summer, my sister's warnings. It was all on the outside. All the noise shut out of our world. I remember the quiet when the door closed. Just the sound of us. I quiet myself then and listen to the same sound. The sound of us. Breathe in, breathe out. A hand over silk. Another hand over starched cotton. A sigh.
You really don't have to tell me.
My intentions were good. I was going to test him. See if he would really go through with it. Our first time together in that car. At a party we both wanted to get back to. And with that girl waiting for him. And if he didn't stop, then I would be the one to pull away, to tell him he was an asshole and end things for good. I rest the back of my head against Jonathan's chest and close my eyes. I think maybe it was just an excuse. Permission I gave myself to be in that car with him, to let things go too far. Part of me wasn't ready to let go. Part of me still believed that I could, I don't know, break through, maybe. It made no sense to me why he would keep coming back if he really felt nothing. The memories spring from hiding, the months of analyzing his every move, his every word. Rationalizations, justifications, advice from my friends. Maybe this, maybe that. I wish I'd met Dr. Brody sooner. I wish someone had told me the truth. It's an illusion. He's never going to love you. But then I also wish I had never met Dr. Brody. I wish I still had my illusions. Nothing has filled the empty space they left behind. Jonathan slips his arms away. He takes a step back, leans against the refrigerator door. I turn around to face him. What? I ask.
I don't want to get carried away. I'm very attracted to you, but we've just met.
My mind twists with this new information. It would have been so easy, but he's pulled back. I'm not 17 anymore, I say.
I know that. I'm just trying to be respectful. It sounds like you've had some bad experiences, and I don't want to be one of them.
Holy shit. Does this man know me? Already, he knows how to get inside.
So, what happened in that car?
He asks, and I am reminded about the part that comes next. The part about the dead boy. I never got to find out which one of us might have stopped. If he would have done what you just did, or if I would have followed my plan, or if I would have stopped caring about anything but getting more from him, any small piece, no matter how destructive. I remember the sound of footsteps outside the car. The road was gravel, the kind with small stones that kick up when you walk over them.
Is that why they didn't find footprints? He asks.
You really do know a lot about this.
Yes, you do, Jonathan Fielding. It was in one of the articles. That homeless man, Lionel Casey, his lawyer made a big deal about that. The absence of any evidence that he was at the scene.
But then they found him in the car, didn't they? Jonathan nods.
Yes, they did.
He was crazy, you know, and dangerous. People came forward after they heard. people who'd seen him in the woods and been scared. He chased a girl half a mile, screaming that he would send her to hell. He used to dress up in a vampire cape.
Laura, I know. I'm not saying he wasn't there. But all these details from the scene, they all played a role in how you were treated, or mistreated, I should say.
Mistreated. That was not a word I had ever thought to use about that night. It was not a word anyone had ever used to describe what had happened to me. I guess I'm still defensive, I try to explain. I still feel responsible.
I don't see why you would.
I look at my bare feet, at my naked toes, and I think about the moment I put on the shoes I later took off at his door. It wasn't more than a few hours ago that I was in Rosie's attic, getting ready to meet this man. What am I doing? Mitch was there because of me, I say.
No, you were there because of him.
You should have been a lawyer. And then I think, maybe he is a lawyer. It's funny that he could be, and I would never know. But then it's not, really.
Seriously, I don't get how you feel responsible or guilty. He could have killed you as well.
I wonder if it's really possible that he is the only person who has ever said this to me, that I was mistreated in the aftermath, that I could have been a victim myself. You can't forgive her. You want her to suffer. There was no time. I continue with the story. The footsteps on the gravel, we both heard them and looked up. They stopped when we did, and we both saw the same thing. A figure looking into the front seat on the driver's side. He had his hand over his eyes like he was trying to block what little light there was that night. The keys were in the ignition. Mitch had turned on the radio. I was confused. I thought it was someone from the party or a cop maybe, so I stayed very still. Mitch must have thought the same thing, because he didn't move either. Then I heard the door handle click, metal on metal. He wasn't trying to be quiet, to sneak up on us. He just saw us, and we were in the way of him in this car. Mitch was lying on top of me, his feet close to the door. And Lionel Casey just grabbed him by the ankles and pulled him out. Silence descends upon Jonathan's bare kitchen. I can see he's horrified by this image, but I stay hidden behind my wall. Even as I recall the exact feeling of Mitch's body being dragged over mine, his hands grabbing hold of anything they could find, instinct taking over. I had scratches down my face and neck, and the sides of my torso, because my shirt was pulled up. They found my skin under his nails, and fabric from my jeans. One of my shoes was found on the gravel, because that was the last thing his hands found as they tried, desperately, to keep from leaving the safety of the car. I didn't see him, Lionel Casey. The figure looking through the window was just that, a figure, a shadow. I think he was wearing a hoodie or a jacket with a hood, because I couldn't make out the shape of his head. But I wouldn't swear to that. And when Mitch was dragged out of the car, I couldn't see beyond his face. I was lying on my back, kicking against the seat to move away from the open door. I never saw beyond Mitch as he was pulled outside. And when I felt his hand release from my foot, taking my shoe with him, I kicked myself up and away to the other door, opened it, and ran outside. I ran until I was deep in the bushes that lined the road, and then I crouched down, hiding and listening.
My God, Jonathan says.
And I can see that what really surprises him the most is that I can tell this story without flinching, without crying, without anything at all. I heard him plead, no, stop, please. It was breathless, like the fear had paralyzed his voice. I didn't hear the bat hit his body. People said I did, but that's because what I heard were breaks in his pleas. Changes to them that anyone would know was from some kind of strike to his body that knocked the wind out. And then they said that I only heard 3 blows, and yet there were 4 to his body, 4 swings of the bat. But I never said I heard 3 blows. I said I heard 3 breaks to his pleading. Jonathan stares now, wide-eyed.
The fourth blow might have come after he was already dead, or unconscious. That's why you only heard three breaks.
I nod. Yes. That might be how it happened. I heard the car door close and the engine rev. The headlights never came on, but I also heard the car peel away on the gravel. I didn't wait after that. I crept out of the bushes to where I could see. I didn't know if Mitch had gotten away and left this person in the road, waiting to get me next, or if this person had stolen Mitch's car. So I was quiet and cautious until I could see. And then I did. I did see Mitch on the ground, his body still. That's when I screamed and ran toward him. I stood over his body. Blood was coming from his head and his mouth. It pooled, but it also sprayed. I screamed and screamed, spun around in circles looking for this madman. It wasn't rational because the car was gone, but I just felt this wave of panic and fear, so I kept scanning the woods, waiting for someone to come and help. I saw the bat a few yards away, and what went through my mind was that this was a weapon I could use to protect myself. I wasn't thinking about fingerprints or evidence. I was afraid for my life, even though it doesn't make sense since I knew the man was gone. The fear had not left with him. It was right there, all around me. I felt like I was prey out in the open, looking everywhere, in front, behind, near, far, frantically. Each time I turned my head, new fear came about what might be jumping from the shadows in the place I turned from. I remember that part so well. The terror and the desperation to be safe. Finally, they came. My sister and others from the party, they came seeping from the woods, their hands covering their mouths in horror as they saw Mitch bleeding on the ground, and saw me standing over him, holding that bat and screaming like a lunatic. Every last one of them, including my sister, came to the same conclusion. I knew right then and there because they didn't run to me or to Mitch to try to help us, to calm me down or stop the bleeding. They just stood and stared the way people do when they stumble upon a crime scene. I was surrounded by people, friends, and even family, and yet I was completely, painfully alone. Jonathan stares now too, scrunched brow, open mouth. I know this look well. I seem to bring it out in people. But I can't stand seeing it, not now, not on Jonathan Fielding. I turn around so I don't have to bear witness. I see my purse and pull it toward me. One hand reaches in, looking again for the phone and possibly a charger hidden, perhaps among the debris I shoved in there from my other bag. Laura. His voice is deep and soft. He stands behind me again, like he'd done before I finished my story. He wraps his strong arms around me, just like before. He kisses the top of my head. Not like Rosie does with Mason, a quick peck as he races off. His lips linger long enough for me to feel his breath. I'm so sorry that happened to you, he whispers. And then I feel his cheek pressing against mine. I close my eyes and let my hand rest inside the purse. I am the one who begins to melt now. His pulse quickens. He kisses my neck, melting. Melting. I am a woman on fire.
Tell me to stop and I will.
His hands run down the sides of my waist, slow but firm. One of them finds the front of a thigh, the other finds the back.
Tell me,
he says again. He almost pleads. I am pulling him to that treacherous place, the point of no return. Walk away. It's just an illusion. I know that now, and yet I am still helpless. I feel the rush, the power over this man. I am an invincible woman. I am a helpless child, tugging on a sleeve, watching as the head begins to look down. Eyes from above are about to turn, about to see me. I am so close, I can feel it in my bones. My hand is still inside the purse, but it no longer feels for a charger. It wants to touch him, this man, Jonathan Fielding. I pull my hand from the bag and feel the metal zipper scratch against my knuckles. But my fingertips, they brush against something cool and stiff. A piece of paper. And a horrible thought rushes through me. A note? He grabs my hips and spins me around. His mouth finds mine. I suddenly know nothing of the paper in the purse or the scrape from the zipper, as my hand is now free, reaching beneath his shirt to touch his body. Both hands find his shoulders, then his head, sweeping through his hair. "Walk away," I try to tell that woman. But she won't listen. She never listens. She deserves what's coming.
Chapter 27. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 10 a.m., Branston, Connecticut. Gabe sat across from Rosie at the same diner where she'd met the woman from the bar. She'd sent Joe a quick text. "Still in NY, call if you hear anything." Then she'd turned off her phone. She showed Gabe the notes and told him about New York. He was with her every step, not missing a beat. "So the boyfriend was the shrink, the one she said she'd been seeing?" Gabe asked. He looked as tired as Rosie felt, cradling a ceramic coffee mug between two palms. "It would be just like her to seduce her therapist," Rosie said, then wished she could take it back. "God, that's horrible, isn't it? How can I say things about her when she's in this much trouble?" Gabe reached over and grabbed her hand. His skin was warm, comforting, and it suddenly occurred to her that she and Joe never held hands anymore. "Rosie, nothing you do or say right now is going to be judged. Not by me, at least. It is like Laura to do something like that. She always went for the highest climb, the guys who seemed impossible to conquer, even if it was just because they were assholes."
"Like Mitch Adler," Rosie blurted out.
Gabe didn't flinch, even though she expected it. "Yes, like Mitch Adler. And this man, Kevin Brody, he was off limits for every possible reason. He was older, he was married, he had kids, and he was her shrink. That's Mount Everest right there."
"Christ, Gabe, I can see her, you know, sitting in his office, being vulnerable but clever. She probably cried."
"I know. I can see it too, walking past him a little too close, brushing his shoulder as she passed by, looking up with soft eyes." Rosie thought about that picture on her computer. Somewhere along the way, Laura had learned that sadness and longing didn't get her what she needed. So she'd become sexual, irresistible. "She doesn't know she's doing it," Gabe said. "I truly believe that. It just kicks in like a car shifting gears."
"And now he's dead."
Rosie pressed her hands to her face. Gabe leaned closer, lowering his voice. "Wait a minute. You don't think she had anything to do with that, do you? It was a robbery." He grabbed his phone and pulled up the article Rosie had sent him. "Okay, here. He was struck with something from behind, knocked to the ground, where he hit his head a second time against the cement. It took over an hour for him to die."
"Struck with something. Knocked to the ground. Is it really that crazy? You're the one who told us about that story with your brother, at the fort, remember? How she hit him with a stick? Looked like a wild animal?"
"Rosie." Gabe stopped himself. Rosie could see that he knew. He couldn't deny any of it. Laura had a history of violence going back to her early childhood.
"She could be more psychotic than we know, Gabe. I love her, but sometimes you can love someone, think you know them, and then suddenly you find something out and your eyes open to a different world."
"His name was Joe."
Rosie could still hear Kathleen saying those words. "Let's just back up," Gabe said. "Step one, find Laura. That's it. That's all we have to do. Then we can figure out what's been going on with her."
"Okay,"
Rosie said, pulling herself back. She wanted to tell Gabe about Laura and Joe, but she didn't even know what there was to tell. Was it an affair? A flirtation? Why the hell was her husband calling her sister? Why had he gone to her apartment weeks before she'd come back home?
If it was anything other than an affair, if Joe was helping her, counseling her somehow, maybe for the murder of her boyfriend, he would have told Rosie. Nothing would have been worth the fallout if he kept it from her. The fallout that was now upon them.
"The way I see it," Gabe began, "we now have three possibilities. First, Laura found out about this guy being a player and can't face whatever it is she did that night. Second, something went wrong when she found out, and one of them got hurt. But there's a third one now, and it has to do with those notes."
"I've thought of that," Rosie said, thankful Gabe didn't use the word dead, even though they both knew that was a possibility.
"If this guy is more than just a womanizer, if he's a professional con man, then it's possible he targeted Laura in connection with Mitch Adler's murder."
"But why now, Gabe? I mean, she lived an hour away in New York. It's not as though she's been in hiding. And who would have gone to all this trouble? Who would even know she was on a dating website?"
"It could be anyone affected by the murder. A family member, a friend. And what about Lionel Casey? Maybe he had family, and maybe they have a vendetta because he spent his life in a mental facility against his will. If they were all just going about their business, and then one day someone saw Laura in town, it could have broken the dam."
"Or," Rosie's eyes opened wider, "Gabe, what if she was on this date last night and that's when someone saw her? Someone close to Mitch Adler or Lionel Casey who believed she was responsible for the death? What if this has nothing to do with Jonathan Fields or Laura finding out about him and freaking out? What if we're chasing the wrong lead?"
Gabe agreed all of that was possible. "We should tell the police, Rosie, about those notes, about the connection to the past. They can find people faster than we can."
Rosie wasn't sure. That would mean bringing everyone back to that night in the woods. She hadn't heard from the two officers since yesterday evening. She'd assumed that they hadn't put the pieces together about Laura Lochner, past and present, because if they had, they would have called her. Telling them about the notes would make that inescapable.
"Rosie," Gabe said, "why didn't Joe show them to the police when they were at the house?"
Rosie shrugged. "I think he didn't want them to focus on the past. To not take it seriously, finding Laura."
"Okay," Gabe said, nodding a little too hard. She could tell he wasn't buying it.
And Rosie had no patience for guessing.
"What?
Do you think it's something else?"
"No, I just... Look, don't take this the wrong way, but sometimes when I'm at your house and you've gone upstairs with Mason, we all keep drinking and talking, and then sometimes I leave and they pour another round."
"What are you saying?"
"That sometimes they stay up talking, alone. I have no idea what it's about, but maybe Laura confided in him about something. Maybe about the notes or something else. Maybe Joe's afraid to expose her to the police."
His name was Joe.
First Kathleen, and now Gabe, telling her things about her husband and sister. This could not be happening. Not to her own family. Was there no end to the trouble? Would it follow them forever? "He went to see her, Gabe," Rosie blurted out then. She couldn't be alone in this.
"What do you mean?"
Gabe looked surprised, shocked even. And something else, territorial, protective. His alliance had always been with Laura, and Rosie was now putting the pieces together. That story about his brother. That had to have stayed with him, made him feel responsible for her and whatever damage Rick Wallace had caused. Laura's roommate heard them on the phone and saw Joe with her at the apartment in New York. Before she moved. Before the breakup with the shrink. If there even was a boyfriend. Maybe that was all a ruse. A distraction.
"That doesn't make any sense," Gabe said, thinking. "You don't believe..."
"I don't know, Gabe." Rosie let the tears come now. It was too much. Too fucking much.
"No way."
Gabe shook his head as though he could erase the thought from both of their minds.
"Not Joe. He loves you. He always has. Always. And Laura. She would never do that to you, even if she did have feelings for him after all these years."
Rosie wiped her eyes and gathered herself. She was in an alternate world now, where nothing was known or unknown except the facts. Joe had been seeing Laura behind her back. Joe had been having secret conversations with her at the house. Joe had found the notes, conveniently, after the police left. And Joe had found the car. This last fact suddenly jumped out above the rest. "He found the car," Rosie said. "Joe. And in less than an hour." Gabe was silent, his eyes fixed on Rosie. He took her hand again and pressed his lips against her palm. Then he squeezed it hard between his own, and she imagined that he didn't believe it. But then he also did. And now he was going to be her protector, even from his best friend, the man he'd known since childhood. His phone buzzed on the table right beside their hands. Gabe broke away from the embrace and picked it up. "It's a message," he said, pulling it up to the screen. "Shit. From findlove.com. From Second Chance." Rosie gasped. The woman from the website who'd gone quiet. The woman who'd told them to run. "What did she say?"
"She gave us a phone number. She said she'll talk to us."
Rosie stared at him, eyes stinging now from the exhaustion and the tears. She'd already heard one story about this man, this Jonathan Fields, from Sylvia Emmett, a woman he'd picked up at a bar and then lied to and mistreated. Now they had the woman from findlove.com. What story was she about to tell? Rosie was afraid to find out.
"Are you ready?"
he asked her, looking at her with steadfast resolve. It didn't matter if she was ready or not ready. They had to find Laura. Everything else would fall into place. She opened her mouth, but it was bone dry, so she didn't speak. She met Gabe's eyes and nodded. "Yes."
Chapter 28. Laura. Session number 3. 4 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
"Do you worry when you're here? When you're with me?"
Laura. "No." Dr. Brody.
"You don't wonder if maybe you're doing it again. With the wrong man. A man who will never love you."
Laura. "Well, now I am. Thanks." Dr. Brody.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put thoughts in your head."
Laura. "Isn't that your job, Kevin?" Dr. Brody.
"I suppose it is. Hopefully good thoughts, or correct thoughts, I should say."
Laura. "I would only be worried if I thought you were going to break my heart." Laura. "You're not going to do that, are you?"